Thank you, Paul. I was tempted after Monday night to turn this into a discussion about leading great football schools and telling you that the secret is to find a quarterback who is an engineering major. But what I'm going to talk about tonight are really some thoughts that I've developed in the process of serving on the National Academy Committee focused on exactly this issue, the future of our research universities, driven by a request from Congress to talk about what are the 10 most important actions we could take inside the university at the state level and at the federal level to address what is perceived to be a major challenge coming from outside the United States. Those of you outside of science and engineering and medicine will forgive me if this talk becomes a little science, medicine, and engineering centric. It's not because I don't believe we have problems outside of those areas, but because those are so tied to all the issues surrounding competitiveness. And I think also, should we suffer major blows in terms of our leadership in science, medicine, engineering, the technology fields, the rest of the university will not be far behind in going down. So with that said, what I'm going to do is first start with a little good news, then talk about some of the challenges we face in terms of the financing of research, education in science and engineering, the health of our public institutions, and then talk about some opportunities. I think any plan which talks about how we're going to address the challenges we face has to think not only about challenges and changes at the federal level, but also what we might do inside the institutions to improve our own operations. So I'll talk a bit about that. I'm going to move pretty quickly. This is actually a longer talk that I compressed, so you'll see a lot of facts and figures. I'm a data-driven kind of person, but we'll have time for some questions after that. So the good news. American research universities are widely considered to be the best in the world. We're widely admired. Any set of studies you look at, whether it's the Shanghai Jiao Tong, the Times Higher Education, any of these ones really puts the U.S. in a leadership position. That's the good news. We also have, by far, the best track record in the world of moving our innovations from the research laboratories out into industry where they do contribute to the economic vitality of the country. I think that innovative and entrepreneurial spirit, for the most part, remains strong inside our universities and is still going. And competition among institutions has really bred excellence. The competition between public institutions and private institutions at higher education in the United States is a model which we should think about what it's done for higher education as we think about the reforms that we need in K-12 education. There's incredible competition. I tell people, we don't just compete with Berkeley on the football field. We compete with them for faculty, for students, and I think it's made us all better for that part. What are the challenges we face? Well, in the National Academy report, Rising Above the Gathering Storm in 2005, they talk about what you might imagine are the key issues. Stagnating research support, emerging well-funded competition, particularly in Asia, the lack of U.S. student interest in science and engineering, graduate students, which are increasingly international. Not that that's not a great thing. This country has been built with incredible talent from around the world. But that's an increasingly uncertain future for us, both because of occasional uncertainty in Washington about visa policies and how they should work, but also, obviously, there's going to be more competition for the best and brightest people as we increasingly realize that it's a knowledge-driven economy that everybody's looking for. My add to that is a real lack of scientific literacy broadly among the U.S. populace. I'll touch on this just briefly just to show you some startling numbers. Recently, this report was updated with a title that says Approaching Category 5, and their key insight was that there was little progress. Things had actually gotten worse, especially on research funding and the budget. And I would add to that, the public institutions are under incredible stress right now, and they face a difficult challenge. I'll show you some insight into why that's happening. But here's this chart just to start us, the trends in federal R&D as a percentage of GDP. Now, I think the right measure here isn't how we're doing against inflation, but how we're doing against GDP. Because if the goal is that our research investments help with issues of economic growth, they are the seed corn for economic growth in this country, then the right measure is against GDP. And you'll notice there are ups and downs here, but the general trend line is slowly going down over time. And that's a concern that I think we need to worry about. It's also very different by discipline. And in fact, showing you that first chart really offsets things a bit because there's very big disciplinary changes. The NIH budget has gone way up. I attribute this to the fact that Congress has a lot of old guys who don't want to die. So they put money into NIH with the hope that whatever disease they're going to get will be cured before they get it. But if you look at some of these other areas in real dollars, they've gone down or they've stayed flat in real dollars, which then is a percentage of GDP is going down overall. And particularly in the engineering disciplines, this has become an increasing concern. But put this against the world stage. Where are the dollars, R&D dollars in the world spent? And look at this number in Asia Pacific. Look at the rapid change that's occurred here from 96 to 2007. It's accelerating there while it's slowly dropping in the US and Europe. That's, I think, the key issue is governments in Asia are making investments in these areas while we are reducing our investments, at least in real terms. This is a chart where I put together four pieces, four different things. High-tech exports, articles published, R&D expenditures, and the number of researchers. And everything here is normalized to what happened in 1996. The reason I normalize it is, if you look at China, the number of high-end engineers, the number of articles they're publishing is still small on an absolute scale. But when you look at how it's changed in the last 10 years, the numbers are truly astonishing. Look at this high-tech exports number. Look at the articles published. That's the real change. They're changing very quickly, very rapidly, and they will play a major role. This shows you what's happened in terms of degrees. It's a chart that shows the ratio of the first degree holders in science and engineering to the population. So 24-year-olds, what percentage of those people have a degree in science and engineering? You'll notice that in 1975, we were roughly fourth or fifth place, tied with a lot of other countries. Since then, we've had a lot of growth. We're now outdistanced by Finland by a considerable number, but look at all the other countries that are ahead of us in terms of percentage of the population majoring in science and engineering. Wow. Can everybody in the back hear me if I don't stand in front of the mic? I'm usually loud enough. Although after the Orange Bowl, I had no voice, so I guess. That was a rough first half, I'll tell you. I almost had a heart attack in that first half. I was going to have to take some extra blood pressure medicine, but
it worked out okay.
But that's a real concerning number. While we've seen the numbers go up in other parts of the world, they've actually gone down as a percentage of population in the United States. Oh, the video's not picking me up. Maybe I should just stand here then. Even when I yell, the video doesn't pick me up, huh? Of course, for a long time, we've had a large number of students from outside the U.S. getting PhDs and being part of that PhD population. That number is now up 50% to 50% in engineering. We are absolutely dependent on this flow of people. And when you couple, I think, some data I'll show you later, which is how we're doing in terms of our own K-12 students in science, engineering, science, mathematics, you see that we cannot afford to lose this flow of talent coming into the U.S. We absolutely need it. It is going to take, in my book, a long time to fix the core problem we have in terms of our K-12 system. And so in the meantime, our only choice if we're going to produce people to work in these fields will be to continue to import the best and brightest from around the world. And we've got to ensure that that can continue, that we can get through possible visa issues. Unfortunately, we have people in this country who don't believe we should keep that door open and would like to see it shut, or would like to see people, once they get their degree, mandatorily be sent home. I'm actually in the category that goes for the staple the green card to the diploma category. After all, if you think about what kind of investment this country has made in somebody who gets a PhD in these fields, $250,000, $500,000 investment we've made in them, to then say, well, you should go home right away is just foolhardy. Public interest in science-related issues remains amazingly high. This is one of the things I think that's absolutely stunning when you look at these different... Is this turned on?
He's got it.
When you look at these different disciplines, there's still lots of interest in a number of these, particularly in medical discoveries. Again, it's the not dying thing. But also other new technologies. The one thing that's fallen off is space exploration. There's a downturn in interest in that, but in other fields... lots of interest. The solution to this is sending more of those little robots up there. Those were very popular. So that says there's lots of interest, but how are people doing in terms of scientific literacy? So this is an interesting chart which shows what percentage of the people knew the answer to very basic scientific questions in different parts of the world. It's not just that the U.S. has a problem with scientific literacy. The world has a problem with scientific literacy. So some of these I was actually amazed by. Look at whether or not the Earth goes around the sun or the sun goes around the Earth. And you notice that something on the order of 25 or 30% of the people in the U.S. get it wrong. In this day and age. You know, Galileo got in a lot of trouble for not getting this right. So, but... there's a lot of things that are wrong. Lasers, radioactivity. They do know that the center of the Earth is hot. That's a good thing. They've seen it in science fiction. But it shows you, I mean, these are fairly basic things. I'm not even asking a question as difficult as why are there seasons, why are there tides, things that require a little more fundamental understanding. So we really do have a challenge here. And I think if you look at this, if you look at this challenge and try to get at what's underneath it, there was a really excellent article written by Jonathan Cole, the former provost of Columbia, that talked about the elimination of scientific progress in the teaching of American history. And he goes through a long discussion of this, pointing out that many American history books had lots of things about modern culture, about the sexual revolution, about women's liberation, but very little about the way in which science and technology had changed the world we live in. And if we don't tell people this is important and they need to understand it, we're going to suffer the consequences. And of course, this is important when the country is making such a large investment in science and engineering. It's important for people to have an understanding of why that investment is important to them and how it's changing their world. So it's an area where I think we still have a lot of work to do globally. Of course, our public research universities are also in significant difficulty. This just shows you what's happening at the very high research. So this is sort of be UC level, and this would be institutions that have research programs but are not at the top level in the Carnegie classification. And you'll see that the state appropriations have gone steadily down over time in 2006 dollars against inflation. And of course, that's undermined these institutions significantly. They're probably in one of the most difficult times that they've ever been in. One result of that, of course, is that there's been a steady boost in tuition. This is net tuition in the publics as a percentage of revenue. It's gone from 24.5% a year up here to now 37.3% a year. So they're highly tuition dependent. That generates lots of other difficult things. This is in the research universities as well, right? Stanford, by comparison, I think we're probably about 13% of our revenue is tuition. So it creates a real exposure for them in terms of, and it becomes a very, if you're thinking about how you raise your income, then tuition becomes the very natural way to do it. So it's a major challenge. When you begin to look at what's actually happened here, one of the key drivers has been what's happened in Medicaid spending. Medicaid spending by the states has gone from 0.4% of the gross state domestic product now up to 0.9%. In some states, it has already passed by their investment in K-12 education. So that's a real concern, I think, and again gets back to a fundamental problem. If you take that problem to the next level and look at what's happened in terms of the federal budget, this is really why I worry about research funding. I worry that we haven't seen the worst case scenario by a long shot yet, and that the coming crisis in the growth of entitlement spending is going to be really problematic. This line is the percentage of GDP that has been extracted in taxes over time. You'll notice that this line is remarkably straight across time as a percentage of GDP, right? So tax rates have gone up and down, but as a percentage of GDP, this is roughly where they run. If you look at the bottom of these charts, you've got Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and right out in here somewhere, and interest on the national debt, which we do have to pay. So somewhere between 2040 and 2050, that combination of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and interest on the debt exceeds all the tax revenue. If you assume that the percentage of tax revenue as a percentage of GDP is the same, all the tax revenue. There's no money for national defense. There's no money for investing in infrastructure. There's no money for investment in education. This is a gigantic crisis. Our colleague George Shultz and John Chauvin have written about parts of this. If we don't solve this problem, my view is we enter a death spiral where what happens is we cut back on investments in research and education. That leads to a lower GDP growth rate, which then leads to these entitlements taking an even larger fraction, which leads to an even lower investment in growing in the things that will lead to growth in the GDP. And we just enter a cycle that's very difficult to get out of. And unfortunately, the problem we face is when you tell the American public, we face a crisis out 30 years, 40 years from now, we'll worry about it then. We'll worry when we get out 30 or 40 years. But the problem with this, if you don't begin to turn the curve now, you're never going to solve the problem. And I think this is the thing that worries me the most about our set of challenges. So what can our universities do? What role can we play? Well, clearly many of the challenges we face are going to require policy changes at the federal government level. I think if we could really get one significant change, we could convince Congress that keeping the funding levels, growing them at the GDP rate is the right thing to do and is the appropriate investment for the country. That would make an enormous difference. Urging Congress to make visa reform a priority would be incredible. That way we'll encourage the best and brightest international students to stay. But I think universities are also going to have to ask what they can do to help themselves. Clearly, one thing is to continue to speak out against earmarking, to continue to speak in favor of merit-based research programs, because it has been one of the stronger aspects of our entire research funding. Continuing to educate great leaders, innovators, and teachers, which I'm going to come to in a second. Preparing people for a science and technology-shaped world. Engaging all our citizens, which is another key issue I want to touch on. And I want to talk a little bit about what we could do to improve the efficiency of our own system to try to make ourselves better. So, educating leaders, innovators, and teachers. A residential liberal education is the foundation, I think, that has made our education system the envy of all the world. You notice that in many parts of Asia now, they're thinking about a different view. They started out saying, we want engineers and scientists. Now they're beginning to think about what are the values of a broad liberal education in the context of a residential program that brings together people from different backgrounds and helps train people who will be lifelong leaders and educators. We have to nourish the entrepreneurial spirit and the tech transfer. It's clear that we've got challenges around conflict of interest, and my concern here is that Congress becomes so concerned with conflict of interest that they build a wall between universities and industries, and we will destroy something that works very well in this country. And as I pointed out recently to some colleagues in Washington, I've had junior faculty tell me that they don't want to have anything to do with any companies, because if they do, then NIH won't fund them anymore. So this is a real concern, because we'll break something that actually has worked rather well in this country. And finally, educating teachers. We need to fix science and math education in our K-12 system, and it will be key to the future of the universities in the long term. So let me just show you quickly how U.S. students are doing internationally. This is the international TIMSS math test. I could show you the science numbers. They're roughly the same. The U.S., you'll see the U.S. here. We're down here with the average of three other OECD countries, which means there are 15, 16, 17, 18, 19 countries ahead of us. I believe we do roughly as well as Bulgaria on this test. By the way, Bulgaria spends about one-tenth as much per student as we spend. So we've got a gigantic problem here. One of the key reasons it's so bad in these areas is that a very small number of the teachers, particularly as you go up in grades, have backgrounds in science and math. So they're teaching a topic that they were not trained in. And I think in science and math, it's a very difficult problem to overcome. And these numbers, by the way, are overall national numbers. You go into inner city schools, these numbers get much worse for the inner city schools. So we've got to think about this problem. We've got to think about how we reform the system, how we train people. This is going to require a major overhaul of what we do in K-12 education, because the only way we're going to persuade talented people who have a degree in science or mathematics and could get a high-paying job is to persuade them that they're going to get a professional job in K-12, they're going to be treated as professionals, they're going to be compensated reasonably well, and they're going to make a big difference in the lives of young people. And if we don't do that, we're never going to fix the problem. We can train all the people you want, but if you have a system that doesn't treat them as professionals, it won't work well. We've also got to work on how we attract a broader fraction of the population into the STEM fields, into science, technology, engineering, and medicine. This puts it in a very simple form. So this shows you what our K-12 public enrollment is right now in the U.S. So just about 39% is underrepresented minorities. When you then look at the college-age population, the fraction of underrepresented minorities drops. It drops again at undergraduate enrollment. It drops again in terms of science and engineering degrees. It drops again at master's degrees. And it finally plummets when we get to doctoral degrees. So the representation goes from 39% to just over 5% in terms of getting PhDs. And the demographics of this population continue to change. It's this part of the bar that's growing, not this part of the bar. So that number is going to get bigger. If we don't figure out how to do a better job of attracting and retaining underrepresented minorities in science, engineering, medicine, mathematics disciplines, we are not going to fix this problem long term. So we've got to work on it and think about it. I could have shown you, by the way, 30 years ago, I could have shown you a similar chart for women in these disciplines. Things have gotten a lot better in terms of representation of women. It's not a problem that's completely behind us, but in most disciplines, we're doing much better. So I think by focusing on it, by thinking about our education system, we can work on this problem and make progress. Here's one chart that shows you what the really interesting problem is. So these show you percentage of individuals who come into college with an interest in getting a degree in science, technology, engineering, or mathematics, and actually finishing it. So five-year completion, or look at the five-year completion numbers, they're better. So you see that Asian Americans do best, whites do worst, and that Latinos, blacks, and Native Americans do considerably worse in terms of their ability to complete degrees. And I attribute this to one major fact. The major fact you can show is that they are insufficiently prepared. And you cannot walk into college thinking you're going to be a major in one of these disciplines without an adequate high school background that includes calculus and physics and really prepares you for college-level work. So we can do more on mentoring. The university's got to do a better job here as well, but we're also going to have to fix the challenge of preparation for these young people. So here's another area where we as universities can do something, how well we do on PhD education. So these are PhD completion rates showing you completion in 5 years, 7 years, and 10 years. Notice that, yeah, isn't that an interesting number? Even in engineering, only 64% of the people who start PhDs finish in 10 years, and the humanities only half finish in 10 years. Not that 4 years or 5 years of working on a PhD is necessarily a complete waste of time, but it's a gigantic investment of money, and there's an opportunity cost that's lost, because that individual, that's a highly capable individual, if they're even enrolled in a PhD program, they could be out making other contributions in society, earning a living, doing other things, even paying taxes, for example. So the fact that we've got these kinds of completion rates is a real problem. Stanford's numbers are better than this, you'll be glad to know, but they're not 100%. They're not even close to 100%. In engineering, for example, which is the highest at Stanford, too, we're around 75%. If you go and look at the data, the bad news is, guess what? All those students didn't drop out of their first and second year. They dropped out in their third, fourth, fifth, sixth year often, right? So then that's an investment. If these were all students who were dropping in their first year, concluding that a PhD really wasn't for them, we could live with that, right? But if they're dropping out later than that. So we did a calculation that said what percentage of our graduate research funding is going to students who don't complete their PhD. And at Stanford, it's around 9%. If you extrapolate our numbers to these numbers and adjust for graduation rates, it's closer to 15% nationally. So that's something we could work on and would really improve our system. The other thing for us to work on is time to degree. So time to degree, there's been a slight drop in the last few years, but look at what happened from 1978. See, I was smart. I got my degree in 77 back here. But look at this. From just over 4 years, we peaked at close to 10 years. We're now down running somewhat over 8 years. By the way, if you say, well, the numbers in my lab are much better, they're much lower than that. Stanford's average is in the same territory. It's better than 8, but it's closer to 7 than it is to 6 overall in the institution. And of course, that drives up time to degree, not only time to degree, but the age at which people complete their degrees and how long it takes them and the time they start to begin pre-professional careers. And of course, the thing I didn't add to this is average time spent in postdoc now, which if you add that number has gone up significantly, especially in the biomedical sciences, but also in physics and a number of other disciplines as well. And when you start taking young people and thinking that they're going to get their first faculty appointment at 35. We actually did this computation because I'm sure many of you have heard this number that the average age of a first NIH grant is now 37 or so, 42 maybe. I hear our number's 37. I think it's 42 nationally, but I think ours is 37. Well, it turns out that the average age of their first appointment now is in their young 30s by the time they get done with their PhD and their postdocs. So I think this is a problem. And I think added to it, a key related issue is the number of people getting PhDs who are now going to non-academic careers, of course, has gone up significantly because there simply isn't that much growth anymore in the universities. It seems to me that it's a double waste when we have people spending that long and not heading to a non-academic career. So we can't say anymore, oh, they're working on their publication rate, they're developing their skills as a faculty member, and then they're going to industry. So that's something I think we really need to do a better job of. We could prepare them better for careers outside the academy as well and make an investment in that. If you think of the size of our PhD programs as driven, they're of course partly driven by the federal research investment, but they're also driven by the size of an intellectual community we'd like to have. And if we want to maintain that size intellectual community, we have to think in a more constructive way about the career alternatives for people who aren't going to the academy when they finish their training. Okay, I want to finish this on a positive note because otherwise we'll all be too depressed. So I actually think while we face a number of challenges, I think it's also an incredible time for the universities. Universities have become the home of research and advancement. Industry simply doesn't make the long-term investment in research that it once made in this country. The Bell Labs of the world are gone. IBM research is not what it once was. Our friends at Xerox PARC are not what they once were. There have been enormous changes, and I think it's up to universities to continue to make that investment. We certainly have gigantic problems that we face, whether it's thinking about what we do when silicon is no longer an option for integrated circuits, thinking about the issues around energy and solving the energy problem, thinking about the issues we face in computer science. One of the things I fear the most is we've now encouraged society with all this wonderful technology we built in terms of the internet and the World Wide Web, but we may have encouraged them before we've actually figured out how to solve issues like privacy and security. And when people find that every single thing they've done is essentially accessible to the public, we could find ourselves in a very difficult situation. Of course, all the young people just put it up on Facebook and give it away, so that's a different problem. But I think these kinds of great opportunities in the social security, in areas of the social sciences and the humanities, thinking about issues of better governance, what we do about economic development around the world. These are all key problems that we could work on and really make a contribution to. But I want to finish. I only want to tell one of these three stories here at the end. They're all great stories. So if you haven't read about Carl Dicerolf's work on optogenetics, go read about it. It just got awarded Method of the Year, which is really terrific. And the great work that Gretchen Daly and others are doing on Natural Capital Project. But I want to just talk about one thing, which I think is a really great example of, shows how the kind of work we can do at the university can help change the world and change the lives of the poorest people in the world. And this was a class that was built some number of years ago in the Hasso-Plattner Design Institute called Entrepreneurial Design for Extreme Affordability, currently headed by our colleague in the business school, Jim Patel. Puts together interdisciplinary teams of students. Students with MBAs work together with primarily engineering students, but also sometimes students from the medical school. You have to find students who have nothing else going on in their life, because for two quarters, this course will take over their entire life. The teams actually research and create products for the most challenged 50% of the world. So they only work in countries where the population is below the median, lowest half of the world income. So it generally means countries where the average salary is less than $2 a day. They've worked on low-cost solar lanterns, better manual irrigation pumps, high-efficiency stoves. But the project I love the most is a project to work on a low-cost baby incubator. So a group went to Nepal, discovered that one of the major problems of early infant death in Nepal is babies who are born under birth weight. Under birth weight babies have a problem with hypothermia. They can't maintain their body temperature. So they came back and looked at a design. How could they solve this problem? Well, a Western-style incubator costs $25,000 a year, has to have electricity, which, of course, in many rural areas is not available. Even jury-rigged incubators made with light bulbs cost about $2,500 a year. So they set out to do a design that would bring that cost down to $25 a year. And their design, which we don't need this anymore. Wow, I would never allow that application to accept. Their design is a little tiny sleeping bag for babies. And they made this design. And it uses a piece of technology from MIT, so we have collaboration between two institutions across the United States, basically wax substance that can be dropped in a pot of boiling water. It's in a bag, melts, and then maintains a steady state temperature for an extended period of time. That goes in a back pocket. You slip it in, you put the baby in the front, you tighten it up sort of like a mummy bag, and you can maintain the baby's temperature for about 4 hours in this. And then if the transport time to a better medical facility is longer, you can take the wax pouch out again, drop it in another pot of boiling water. The one thing people in the developing world do have access to are heating sources, so they can reheat it up, put the pouch back in, move the baby there. So a team of graduate students, started by a team of graduate students, they then moved to India, started up a group to pilot this project, working with the hospital in Delhi that works with rural communities around Delhi. and in May, helped save their very first baby, Nisha, who was born prematurely, now actually has achieved a birth weight since May that exceeds her brother, who was over birth weight and didn't have that problem. So this is the kind of thing they can do. They were lucky enough, GE has now asked them about putting in an order for 10,000 of these units that they'll distribute in various parts of India and Nepal. So this is the kind of things that you can do at a university that can really change the world for the better. So we've got this great potential. We've got a lot of challenges, but I think the opportunities are remarkable. Thank you.